Did you know that iron deficiency is one of the most common, yet often overlooked, nutritional gaps affecting 1 in 3 adults, especially women? I'm a lifelong vegetarian, and so getting enough iron has been a constant struggle. There are plenty of times when I tried to give blood and I couldn't because my iron was too low, especially in my 20s when my diet consisted of mostly pasta. So I have had to take iron supplements at various times in my life. So when Siderol from PermaNutra wanted to advertise with us, it was a no-brainer. It's a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea and constipation. It's vegan and gluten-free and 100% allergen-free and free from artificial colorants. So if you feel like no matter how much you rest, you're still running on empty, you're not alone. Over 2 million people have already discovered Siderol, and it could be the support you've been looking for. So head to PharmaNutra-US.com and use code ATTWG for 10% off your first order of Siderol. That's PharmaNutra-US.com, promo code ATTWG for 10% off today. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. If you're like me, then you have different family members who have different ailments, and I've recommended Mood to all of them. I legitimately, before recording this, I told my mom about Mood, and she's going to make her first order. Because they have gummies for all sorts of things, for pain relief, for sleeping, for just improving your mood. Their gummies are specially blended and each one feels different. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I wake up feeling amazing. And each gummy is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. This holiday season, comfort is slowing down and finding calm amidst the chaos. As the holidays fill up with gatherings, travel, and to-do lists, Avocado Green Mattress helps you create a space that's calm, cozy, and restorative. Avocado products transform your home into a peaceful, grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. But more importantly, they offer unmatched comfort. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. And every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and the quality you're bringing into your home. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better. Hey, everybody. So we have a little announcement before we get started this week. This episode is crazy and is actually going to end up being a two-parter. So this week is part one and next week is going to be part two. And also...
And after that, we are going to take a little break.
Yeah, basically I need to get caught up on some things. So we're going to take a little hiatus from regular episodes. So we'll just call next week's episode, which will be episode 16, the end of season one.
And then we'll be putting out small...
kind of more like casual episodes. So, I mean, I watched that Chris Watts documentary, as I'm sure a lot of you did on Netflix. And I actually watched it while Ethan was out of town. And as soon as he got back into town, I made him watch it with me because it's insane.
Yeah. I don't want to get too much into it, but the amount of access that
it's amazing
the documentarians had
was
incredible.
And so we really want to talk about it, but you know, it's not our normal format. So that's why we're going to do this. So we'll do like an in-between seasons kind of thing where we have some episodes that break from the format and, you know, hopefully might be a little fun.
And maybe you'll even hear from our kids.
Oh yeah. They've been begging us to do an episode. So maybe we'll figure something out with them too. All right. Well, that's all we've got. So let's get into part one of our season one finale. It's a warm summer day, and a young woman is sunbathing on a secluded stretch of beach. Suddenly, a man comes up behind her and grabs her by the hair, picks her up, and drags her into the woods, never to be seen again. The only witness? A man across the river watching through a telescope. Does this sound like the beginning of a horror movie? Allegedly, this is exactly what happened to Heather Teague at Newburgh Beach in Henderson County, Kentucky on August 26, 1995. What initially seems like a straightforward but terrifying crime, complete with a quickly identified and located suspect, is actually a confusing mess of possible drug connections, prostitution, and government corruption on multiple levels. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Heather Teague. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Okay, I think my intro, you gave me like the most looks out of any intro that we've done before.
Yeah, I mean, right off the bat, it sounds like Hitchcock's Rear Window.
I know.
I mean, a person looking through a telescope and seeing a murder committed. I mean, if it's not Jimmy Stewart with a cast up leg, like.
I know. It's.
What is going on there?
Crazy, right? Okay, so let's get into it because I'm telling you, like.
Why was this guy looking at her through a telescope? Well, I mean. I can venture a guess as to why he was staring at this woman through a telescope.
Exactly. But. And your guess, I'm sure, is the same guess that everybody, including me, had. But
a little bit dirtier than the plot of Rear Window. But,
although I think Rear Window actually was like a low-key dirty movie because Hitchcock was dirty.
It was Hitchcock, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not to get too into it, but I took a whole class on Hitchcock in
college. I was a film studies minor. We've had this argument many times throughout the course of our marriage. Okay, but let's get into this because as, you know, as my friend Susan pointed out on Facebook, I say that, you know, cases are bonkers a lot, but this one's bonkers.
And it's already starting off that way.
Exactly. Okay. Heather Danielle Teague was born on April 25th, 1972, to Sarah Teague. I couldn't find any information about Heather's father, but I do know that Heather was Sarah's first child, and Heather was eventually the oldest of three. Heather was a smart, pretty, popular girl. In high school, the honor roll student was a cheerleader, and she played basketball and ran track. Heather was even voted homecoming queen.
Wow, all around.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So this is a girl who seemingly had everything going for her and her entire life ahead of her. But after high school, something changed. She apparently didn't go away to college after graduation and kind of stuck around her small town. According to her mother, she ended up falling in with the wrong crowd and eventually got into drugs. Though it seems from reports that this was more recreational than, you know, a debilitating drug habit, but there was quite a large drug scene in the area. So depending on how deep into this she was, it definitely could have been dangerous.
And where is this?
In Kentucky.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Apparently, there was a big meth, a big meth scene there as well as cocaine. So, I couldn't find anything specifically about what Heather was into, but her mom, like, the whole thing about her getting into drugs, that came from her mother in an interview.
Yeah, and but you said it was mildly recreational.
Well, yeah, so there are other reports, like police reports, things like that, where her friends were interviewed after her disappearance, and like they said that, you know, they didn't know about a drug addiction or anything like that.
So chances are it's not meth or cocaine.
Yeah, it's, but I don't
know. We don't know.
Yeah, I really don't know. So, but drugs did come into this. Her mother, Sarah Teague, told the Courier Press in 2017 that her daughter had gotten into, quote, some things she didn't know how to get out of, end quote. At the time of her disappearance, she was also reportedly dating a man 20 years her senior. Yeah, she was 23 at the time, so he was like in his 40s.
Gross.
Yeah. It seems as though Heather also had job problems. 3 days before Heather's disappearance, Sarah came home to find her daughter sleeping on her couch. She had just been fired from her job and said she didn't have anywhere to go. But despite this, Heather was kind of trying to refocus her life. So she was attending classes at Western Kentucky University, and she dreamed of becoming a psychologist. And even Sarah herself, she was planning on going back to school to become a registered nurse. So she said that they were both kind of like making some changes in their lives and
trying to figure themselves out.
Exactly.
What their future is going
to
be.
Yeah, and trying to just make a better future. Between college, the drugs, and the older boyfriend, and getting fired from her job, things were kind of all over the place for the 23-year-old in the summer of 1995. The last time Sarah spoke to her daughter in person was that day that she found Heather on her couch. As Heather was leaving, she said to her, quote, "Heather, why are you so angry?" She told her mother, "I wish I knew." Not much is known about Heather's whereabouts over the next few days, but on Saturday, August 26th, 1995, Heather decided to go sunbathing at Newburgh Beach. Newburgh Beach is basically a strip of sandy land in front of the Ohio River near some farms. Though this was a relatively popular hangout spot, according to a 1995 article in the Northwest Indiana Times, Heather set up her beach chair about 500 feet away from anyone else. And that's probably because she was, like, sunbathing topless and, you know, didn't want to be around a bunch of people.
But there were other people on the beach.
Yes, okay. There were other people on the beach. I don't know how many or, like, how crowded it was. It was a Saturday afternoon in August. You know, so, and eventually there were some more kind of witnesses, not to the actual abduction.
But remember seeing her on the mm-hmm, beach.
Or her car, you know, things like that.
Okay.
What happens next comes from an eyewitness account and is very strange, as we've already kind of talked about. A man named Timothy Wathel was renting a house across the river. So, okay, in this spot, just to give you guys an idea of the geography, the Ohio River separates Kentucky and Indiana. And Tim Wathel was on the riverfront of the Indiana side. He had a telescope and was looking across the water when he saw a woman lying face down on a towel. A man came behind her, grabbed her by the hair, and pulled her up. She grabbed her towel to cover herself, and he dragged her backwards into the woods. All right, and now I'm going to play a little bit of audio from the 911 call.
State Police, Dispatcher Davis.
Yes, sir. I just called the Indiana State Police. I live in Newburgh, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I was sitting at the dinner table. We got through eating dinner, and I got a telescope. I live right on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And I scanned the beach over straight across from the beach from the lock and dam.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a girl on the left-hand side of the trees down here, and she was sunbathing, and she was laying face down, and she had her top undone, and she was just bathing. And I was looking back and forth across the beach. And I told Karen, I said, you know, I just listened to her. I said, I just look at the beach. And about this time, a guy come running out of the trees on the left-hand side, and he ran down and grabbed her by the back of the head of the hair and jerked her up. And she grabbed the towel, and he walked her up into the trees, up on, in the riverbank over here.
Mm.
And I've been watching now for 25 minutes, and I ain't seen her come back. And all of herself still sat down here on the beach.
Okay, I mean, terrifying, right?
Yeah, and I don't want to get too into the weeds about the level of creepiness of this guy, scanning the beach with his telescope.
Right.
While his wife is there.
Yeah, because he mentioned somebody named Karen.
Right.
And Yeah, through, and I, you didn't listen to the entire 911 call, but he never mentions, like, who Karen is, so I do also assume that it's his wife, but I don't actually know.
Yeah, inconsequential to the to the rest of what's going on.
Right, there's some woman named Karen there.
Yeah, but, so he sees this event and waits 25 minutes.
Okay, and that is something that's a huge sticking point with a lot of people. But what I will say is at the very, and you might not have heard this because it, you know, it's at the very, very beginning of the recording. He says he just got off the phone with Indiana State Police.
Oh, okay. So he called Indiana State Police. They were like, it's across the river. It's Kentucky's jurisdiction. And then this 911 call is to...
This is Kentucky.
That's to Kentucky.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that's presumably... what happened, though we do not have that call. And so, and this kind of gets more into like the craziness of this that we'll talk about later. But apparently that first call to Indiana State Police wasn't to 911. Like it was directly to Indiana State Police.
And it was like a non-emergency number?
Or a direct number.
Hmm.
But it wasn't a 911 call. The theory is that he knew somebody at Indiana State Police and called that person.
And then they said, well, that's not our jurisdiction.
Or you know, hey, we'll look into it on our end, but also call Kentucky. You know, we don't know that ISP, like, blew him off or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, obviously when something happens on the Kentucky side, like, Kentucky needs to be involved, you know, obviously, even if Indiana was going to do something about it. Yeah, so that's very interesting. And what, and this is something that we'll get into in kind of part two of this episode, but this recording was just released a few years ago. I want to say like 2017-ish. And Sarah Teague, Heather's mother, had never heard this before. In 2008, she heard another call that she says was not this call that Tim made. And I think that might have been the Indiana call, but I'm not sure. And there's just a lot of confusing timeline stuff about this call. So he says that, you know, so Heather was apparently abducted around 12:45 p.m.
But he said he was sitting down to dinner.
I know. I thought that was weird too, right?
Yeah.
Cause he said, cause at first he's like, oh yeah, I was sitting at the dinner table and maybe you just call it the dinner table.
Oh,
right.
Maybe I misheard that.
No. That's
Does
what
he
I thought.
Actually say but I then sat he, down to dinner.
Yeah. So he says dinner table. And then he says, I sat down to dinner, which is strange.
Right.
But you know, apparently this, like I said, this was in the afternoons. I don't know if he just misspoke or what that was, but that caught my attention as well when I first heard this. And then there's weirdness about, there's a report that he talked to the Indiana State Police at 1:15, which would have been after this call, not before. But I don't know. And this is what I'm talking about. This is why this is a two-parter, because everything... every single part of this case is just nuts. And nothing really adds up. Even though, you know, at first glance, like I said at the top of the episode, this case does seem to be pretty straightforward because there's a witness to the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And as, you know, I'm about to get to, like, they locate a suspect very quickly. Okay. But before we get into all that, I want you to listen to another part of this call where he describes the abductor, because this is key.
Okay.
What did he look like?
He was kind of heavy set. He just had like a blue jean cut-off pants on and tennis shoes. And it looked, I couldn't tell if he had a full beard or if he just had real shaggy hair and or something over his face. But you couldn't.
What color is his hair, sir?
Kind of dark brown.
Was he white or black?
He was white.
White male?
Yeah.
And he had a gun with him?
Yes, sir.
Did he have a shirt on?
Nope, no shirt. He had what appeared to be like, it was a chrome plating because it kept blistering in the sun, you know what I mean?
All right, so you just heard the description that Tim made of the abductor. So, tall, heavy-set guy.
No shirt.
No shirt.
Blue jean cut-off pants. I'm assuming that means, like, shorts, like cut-off jean shorts.
And that's very important. I mean, because that's what I take that to mean too. But in a lot of the reports that were made, it says that he's wearing jeans, like just pants. So I think a lot of people miss the cutoff part of that description. I mean, not that,
Yeah, that could be misidentified or whatever.
So anyway.
He couldn't tell whether he had a beard or shaggy hair.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it looked like something was covering his face.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the chrome-plated pistol.
Right.
Didn't really give a height or an age description.
Yeah, you're right. No age description. I think he did say he was taller.
Okay.
Taller, heavy set. Although so Heather was tiny. She was like 5 feet tall.
Right, but he wouldn't have any frame of reference. He would, so the taller could be anything.
Exactly. Well, that's what I mean. Exactly. So he doesn't know how tall she is. Yeah. So like anybody would look super tall compared to her.
You said she was 5 feet tall?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Anybody. You would be a giant.
I would be tall.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's, okay. Taller, heavy set, white male, no age.
No shirt.
No shirt.
Jean shorts.
Jean shorts. Shaggy hair.
And maybe a beard.
And maybe a beard.
Right. So that is how he describes him on this 911 call. And the reason why I'm drilling this home so much is because this is very different.
Than who they arrested?
No. Well, it's very different from the description that later got reported.
Okay.
Oh, and we do have this entire 911 call embedded on our blog. It's over 8 minutes. But yeah, so you can hear the whole thing for yourself. But let's get back to Tim for a second. I mean, the whole thing sounds a little crazy. Like, how likely is it that some random guy is looking out at the beach through a telescope at the exact moment a woman is abducted? And why? And, you know, so my theory and your theory and basically everyone who hears about this is that he's a creep trying to look at boobs. And that's basically what people have assumed for decades, that he is just like some creepy guy who was renting this house across the river who liked to look at his telescope at people on the beach. Wathel's name wasn't released for years, and even now there's very little information I can find about him. But I did find something interesting. Becky Mash, who has been working on this case with Sarah Teague and runs the blog findheatherteague.com, which I really used extensively for this episode, because she submitted a FOIA request and got a ton of FBI documents and police reports.
Nice.
Yeah. So she is actually the one who posted this 911 call on YouTube. And in the comments section, she wrote a comment that she pinned to the top that says, quote, "Out of respect for Tim Wathel and his family, it's time to set the record straight about one thing. He was not a pervert looking at young women in bathing suits on the Ohio River. Of that, I am utterly sure. All indications point to Wathel being law enforcement and very possibly one of the good guys. This is an extremely complicated case involving undercover drug war concerning methamphetamine supply in Western Kentucky. Is 25 years long enough for Wathel to keep his silence about what really went on that day? Abso-freaking-lutely. But one thing is for sure, a pervert this man is not." End quote.
So that would lend some credence to the theory that he called somebody that he knew.
Directly
with the state police.
Exactly. And, you know, there have been theories kind of bouncing around for a while that he was some sort of law enforcement. I mean, he had a very calm demeanor on the phone, I thought.
Yeah.
For somebody who saw something so terrifying, you know, and he gave good details. And I did have you listen to a part, a different part of the call, which again is on our blog, although I didn't play it here, where he's describing Heather. And something stuck out to me when he was describing Heather, and I was wondering if it stuck out to you too.
No, not particularly.
So he described her as Caucasian.
Oh, instead of saying white?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is typical for law enforcement.
Exactly. And that's at the beginning of the call. I would imagine, you know, like I said, this is a long call, and Tim isn't on for the entire 8 minutes because the last couple minutes of the call is the dispatcher radioing to officers mm-hmm. after Tim gets off the line. But he's on it for like 6 minutes, right? So I would think that the call starts and you're more like, holy crap, I just saw this crazy thing. This is what happened. Like, la, la, la. And then maybe you get calmer as you go on. But this is at the very beginning of the call, and he describes her as Caucasian instead of white, you know?
Right, but he describes the suspect as white.
As white, right.
Yeah. Regardless of whether he's a creep or in law enforcement, like, right place, right time, right thing to do, to call law enforcement, call 911 and report the crime. Let's look on the positive side here. Somebody witnessed it.
Right, exactly.
And called quickly because, yeah. Okay, yeah, 20 minutes, 25 minutes. What was he doing at that time? Was he mm-hmm. just waiting for, I don't know.
Well, yeah, apparently at one point he said that he thought it was like a prank, and that's why he was kind of waiting to see if they came back. I mean, like I said, I don't think he waited the entire 25 minutes,
yeah.
But he did wait some period of time. He didn't call it, or he didn't see it and then immediately call, you know?
Right. But he did call.
He did call, yeah.
And without him,
mm-hmm.
she just would have been gone.
Well, yeah, exactly. And they would have necessarily known what to look for.
Right.
And the investigation did start to get going very quickly after this. Because there was actually a Kentucky State Police officer nearby who was helping somebody who'd gotten stuck in the mud. And so they were able, like I said, to get going on this. Okay, so you can already see, though, that this case isn't exactly straightforward.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm not an investigative journalist. I'm a realtor and a mom who has a true crime hobby. But in researching this case, it's clear that there's a commonly accepted and reported on set of facts, and I'm honestly not sure how much truth is actually in those facts. So I want to tell this story to get that point out there. There's more digging that needs to be done in this case, and I fully believe that we don't know the whole story here, beyond just not knowing where Heather is.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, this episode was difficult to write because it's so complicated. But let's get to the commonly reported facts of this case. The Charlie Project has a rundown of what was reported on Heather's disappearance. It says in part, quote, "The abductor was approximately 6 feet tall and weighed 210 to 230 pounds. He had brown hair and a bushy brown beard. He was wearing jeans and did not have a shirt on. He was also reported to be wearing a wig and a mosquito net at the time he abducted Teague," end quote.
A wig and a mosquito net?
Right! Okay, so that fits with the tall, heavy-set man description that Tim gave, but it says he's wearing jeans and not cut-off jeans, which, again, we talked about, you know, I take to mean shorts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so sure. The part about a wig and a mosquito net, though, is really important because that did not come from the 911 call, and that, to me, seems like something you would mention in this extremely detailed 8-minute phone call.
What are we talking about here with a mosquito net? Like just a net over his head or
is it like one of those weird like safari hats? Yeah, with the netting. I have no idea.
Because he did say it looked like there was something.
Well, no, but he said there's something covering his face, but he said that he wasn't sure if it was a beard or his shaggy hair, not a net.
Right, but if it's just a net and he's from a distance, I mean, I know he. I get that he's looking through a telescope, but you might not, with as quickly as it sounded like that happened, maybe he didn't realize it was a net and couldn't tell whether that was hair or a beard or...
Or a net? Like, those three things are not the same.
I mean, he said it looked like there was something obscuring his face.
Yeah, he's a beard or hair, not like a beard or hair or a third completely different thing. Like, but, okay, so, all right, let's put the net aside, though, for a second. A wig? Like, how would you tell from across the river through a telescope if it's a wig? Because we're not talking like, oh, it
was... Well, he didn't report that.
He didn't, exactly. And right. So let's just say this came from him later. How would he know it's a wig? How would he know? Because it's brown hair. It's not like it's some, you know, Halloween, like,
right,
crazy...
So who's reporting that it was a wig? Because it wasn't him.
I don't know. And it could have been him later, but it wasn't him on that 911 call.
Right.
And that to me is incredibly important because you have to take what he says at the time,
right,
not, you know, necessarily what he's saying later, or even if this did come from him, because we don't know. But that's why I wanted to bring this up, because when I start looking into cases like this for the show, I usually go to their Charlie Project page as one of my very first stops, because that just gives a very general overview of the case. You know, it's short, it's sweet, it tells you like the important parts that you need to know. And then from there, I dig deeper into what happened. Mm. So this whole thing with the wig and the net, that's one of the very first things I read. I was like, that's crazy. I mean, that struck me as being very weird. And what? I saw it repeated in several other sources.
But it doesn't come from the 911 call.
No, but at the time, nobody knew that because this 911 call was just released like 2 years ago.
Where did it come from then?
I don't know. It's one of the many weird mysteries of this case.
Hmm.
But it is obviously important, and it does really come up later when we start talking about the suspect.
Okay.
The Charlie Project goes on to say, quote, Marvin Ray Marty Dill, a resident of Henderson County, Kentucky, was pulled over in a routine traffic stop after Teague's disappearance. He drove a red and white Ford Bronco, which was identical to a vehicle a witness reported was parked next to Teague's car on Newburgh Beach. Authorities discovered a hair resembling Teague's, two guns, two knives, duct tape, rubber gloves, and rope in Dill's vehicle at the time of his traffic stop. The truck had bloodstains on the inside tailgate. Dill also strongly resembled the composite sketch made of Teague's abductor, end quote. All right, so, sounds pretty cut and dry. He had a red and white Bronco with a freaking rape kit inside.
Yep.
Like, that's insane.
And there's blood.
Plus, yeah, and not only was there a witness who said they saw the Bronco near the crime scene, but it was actually caught on video. A local farmer had apparently hired someone to videotape cars that were coming and going because there had been several recent cases of crop vandalism.
Mm.
And so he was trying to catch that person, and he caught the red and white Bronco on that tape. So, like, we have videotaped evidence here. I mean, this does not get much more solid. But if it were that simple, I would have just finished writing this, like, the morning we started recording,
mm-hmm.
you know, after having worked on it all week. That rape kit found in the Bronco, there are reports that it wasn't actually found during the traffic stop after Heather's disappearance, but during a traffic stop in February of 1995, so months before. According to an article in the Northwest Indiana Times written on September 9th, 1995, just weeks after Heather's abduction, quote, court records show that Dill, 30, was arrested in February in Evansville after residents complained he was cruising in his Bronco and soliciting young girls for sex. When they arrested him, police found a small amount of marijuana, two loaded handguns, rubber gloves, duct tape, and rope, end quote.
So all that stuff is found in February, according to that article, right?
Yeah, which is based on court records.
But you said that there was a small amount of blood found in the tailgate.
Good catch.
Was that found in February?
So that's not clear. So that is not mentioned in that September 9th, 1995 article,
okay.
Right? Yeah, so that doesn't say anything about bloodstains. So that's a little difficult to say
okay.
for sure when that was found. But I find it interesting that the story morphed over the years, because this was in 1995. And then in 2006, Heather's original Charlie Project page also said that the rape kit was found in February of 95. But as we saw, the current version of the page
admits that it was all in there
mm-hmm.
at the time
yep.
of the abduction.
Yeah.
Mix up on the timeline. Pretty big.
I mean, that's huge.
So we don't know whether any of that stuff was found at the time of the abduction.
Right. I think
whether that was just found in February.
What I'm leaning toward is the blood was 95, like August to 95, mm-hmm. but the rape kit was not. That's what I'm leaning toward, but I don't know for sure.
Or maybe maybe it was all in there because it's maybe it was a habit of his. I mean, maybe.
Exactly. Maybe it was both.
Right. Maybe this was the February instance was him building up to mm-hmm. what he did to Heather.
Yeah, it very well could be. Yeah, and so, like, he could have had the rape kit in there in February and then again in August.
But we don't have a confirmation on that.
No, and it's changed over the years, and that's part of the thing that's so weird about this story.
Okay, but we have a hair.
Right.
And blood in yes. August.
The hair, definitely in August. Blood, presumably in August.
So, might be jumping the gun here. Were these tested? For DNA. This is 95. DNA exists.
Yeah, but I don't think it was tested for DNA. And I think that's actually one of the current issues is that Kentucky State Police does have evidence that has not been tested. Mm. And presumably that at least partially includes this evidence.
Did they do any hair matching? Well, I guess we don't even have a body, do we?
Mm-mm.
So it's also been proven that, you know, matching hair follicles
is not junk. Yeah.
It's not actual science.
Exactly.
But at the time it would have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's why they made a point of saying it was a hair that resembled right. Heather's because okay. like that's what they were looking at it in terms of like a visual match. I don't think they were looking at it in terms of DNA.
Gotcha.
Rape kit, February, rape kit, August, like
question mark.
Yeah, story changing. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to say that Marty Dill was an innocent man who was set up or anything like that. Just a few days after Heather's disappearance, Kentucky State Police were able to obtain a search warrant to search Dill's home. According to the probable cause affidavit, Detective Robert Atherton said that information about the Bronco was released to the public on August 29th. And the composite sketch was released the next day on the 30th. That night, he received a phone call saying that Marty Dill looked like the sketch and that he also drove a red and white Bronco. They checked vehicle registrations and bingo, Dill's father owned a red and white Bronco.
Mm.
That detective obtained a copy of Marty Dill's driver's license and said that based on that, he looked like the composite. So another officer went to Dill's trailer and spoke with his wife. She confirmed also that her husband drove a red and white Bronco that had a luggage rack, which a luggage rack was another detail that, you know, was seen on the tape and by witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So this probable cause affidavit has a lot of redactions, so it's a little confusing to kind of read and, you know, figure out. It appears that on the afternoon of August 31st, police received two separate calls saying that Marty told his family to get out of the trailer and that he would kill himself if police came. On the evening of the 31st, Dill's wife was interviewed by police and told them that the day before, Marty had told her that the less she knew, the better, and that she needed to leave. She hadn't been able to get in touch with him since. She also told them that the Bronco was hidden in the woods behind their home. A judge issued the search warrant for the trailer and the 2.878 acres surrounding it, which Marty also owned. And then there was another like 20 acres almost that surrounded that was owned by Marty's father.
And the truck was registered to Marty's dad.
Mm-hmm.
Does Marty's dad fit the description?
No. I mean, I think he's too old. Like, he doesn't look like the composite. Like, the composite shows a younger man.
Okay.
The warrant also covered the Bronco and was issued on August 31st, 1995. On the evening of Thursday, August 31st, 1995, Kentucky State Police went to Marty Dill's trailer to execute the search warrant. Now, what I find interesting about this is that Marty had been threatening to kill himself for a full 2 days by this point, and no one had seemingly done anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy, his wife, you know, said that he said that to her like on Wednesday and didn't tell police, didn't say anything to them until they brought her in on the evening of the 31st. And then she's like, oh, yeah, by the way, he told me that he'd kill himself. According to an article written in The Gleaner on September 2nd, 1995, Tracy Dill's wife confronted him on Tuesday about Heather's disappearance and asked him where he was that day. Apparently, he started acting erratically at that point, and it was Wednesday when she and her son left the trailer at his insistence. That's also when he told her he would kill himself if the police came. Between Tuesday and Thursday, KSP also received several calls, which I kind of talked about before, saying the same thing. But apparently, they just continued with the whole search warrant process as normal.
So nobody went out to do a welfare check on him?
No. You know, I'm not a cop, and I've never served a search warrant. But to me, it seems weird and dangerous to go serve a search warrant on a person who has already said that they're going to kill themselves if police came.
Every search warrant is dangerous.
Well, yes.
I mean, at this point, they know that he's got guns.
Yes, that's true.
So they're going to serve the search warrant regardless.
Mm-hmm.
What I find interesting is that they either didn't do a welfare check,
mm-hmm.
or they didn't refer to locals to do a welfare check.
Yeah.
But I don't know the jurisdiction lines for this particular area. Like, it could very well be state police jurisdiction.
It could be. There is, like, Henderson had local police, but this whole case was mainly Kentucky State Police, yeah.
Well, right, they could have been taking the lead on it, but...
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the FBI is also involved in this. So the FBI actually accompanied KSP to the trailer to serve the search warrant on the 31st.
So it's a high-risk warrant.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that they showed up in force with guns ready to go, knowing that he is suicidal and has weapons.
Right.
Okay.
And it's unclear how long KSP was at the trailer trying to communicate with Marty.
Mm-hmm.
But when they arrived, Marty's father was actually in the trailer with him. According to an FBI report, telephone contact was made with Marty's father right before midnight on the 31st. The father came outside and spoke with law enforcement, seemingly for a while, because the report goes on to say that a single gunshot was heard from the trailer at approximately 1 a.m. At that point, law enforcement entered and brought out Dill, who had a single gunshot wound to the head. They took him to the local hospital, where he's pronounced dead shortly after 3 a.m. The police never asked him about Heather, and it is unclear what his father said after exiting the trailer. But here's something else that's interesting about this evening. After his father left the trailer, Marty wasn't alone. There was somebody else inside with him. Marty's uncle, Ernie Green. Or, I guess I should more accurately say, Marty's uncle and ex-Henderson police officer, Ernie Green. For many people, Dill's death is where Heather's case ends. But over the past 25 years, the FBI, the Teague family, and people like Becky Mash have continued to dig into this case. So I want to talk more about this.
Back in 95, let's look at it as a historical perspective on law enforcement here. High-risk warrant, they show up. It's a barricade situation.
Mm-hmm.
They make positive contact. Even if it's not with a suspect, it's with somebody who has direct contact with the suspect. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to go in. They're going to try and talk the person down. So that makes sense to me. Gunshot goes off. Obviously, you make entry. It's not surprising to me that they didn't ask questions of Dill. You know, you said that there was a gunshot wound to his head.
Yeah.
So he's probably not conscious.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They,
no.
They take him to the hospital, doctors work on him, and they pronounce him.
Exactly. So I don't think there was an opportunity after that to ask him questions. What I'm curious about, because it sounds like this, you know, standoff or whatever you want to call it, lasted for several hours. Based on the FBI report, it seems that Dill's father was outside with law enforcement for a full hour before the gunshot. So I would like to know what they were talking about with the father for an hour. I'm assuming they did know that Ernie was in the trailer with Marty.
That's what's confusing to me.
Yeah.
So them being outside with the father for an hour is not surprising to me. That's them maintaining contact with somebody.
Sure.
What I'm confused about is why they didn't have contact with his uncle, who's a police officer.
Former police officer. Yeah, so he was not a police officer at this time.
Okay. Well, we need to get into that.
Oh, trust me, we will, because that is a story in and of itself.
I'm sure.
It doesn't sound like they had any contact with Ernie while he was in there. Gunshot goes off. Ernie runs out of the trailer and tells them that Marty shot himself.
Okay.
And then they go in, and then they bring Marty out, take him to the hospital, et cetera, et cetera.
Were his hands tested for GSR?
I don't fucking think so.
Anybody's hands tested for GSR?
Not that I've
Uncle,
seen.
Uncle,
I don't think so.
Dell himself.
I don't know. I don't think so.
I mean, so you have two people in the trailer. One of them pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the fact that there are two people in the trailer is reason enough to test for GSR.
Mm-hmm. But this has solidly been painted as a suicide since 1995.
Well, sure, it's an easy button up to the case.
Exactly. That's my whole point. The case ended, for all intents and purposes, for most people, when Marty Dill shot himself. Because they're like, okay, red Bronco, like, fits the description. You know, creepy guy, rape kid, he has an arrest record, et cetera, et cetera. He kills himself when cops come. Like, you don't get more guilty than that.
This all sounds like an episode of Justified. Which was also set in Kentucky.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll get into the fact that, as Sarah Teague found out many years later, the description might not have even matched Marty Dill. Next week, we're going to continue the case of Heather Teague and talk more about Ernie Green, the police investigation, and the FBI investigation that occurred a decade after her disappearance. And like I said at the top of the episode, we're talking possible multiple levels of corruption, drugs, and even another viable suspect. We don't have the answers in Heather's disappearance, but someone out there does. And Heather's story and the story of what's going on in Henderson, Kentucky needs to be told. Heather Danielle Teague has been missing since August 26, 1995. She would be 48 years old today. If you have any information about what may have happened to her, please contact the Kentucky State Police at 270-826-3312. Or you can speak directly with Heather's mother, Sarah Teague, at 270-824-8343. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos and that 911 call, on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook, and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for part 2 of our season 1 finale.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S., so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Here are a few things that I'm getting. Unlock the beer escape room. It's a cute little cage that you could put a six-pack of beer in, and then you have to do an escape room to get the code to open the cage. I am absolutely getting this for my brother-in-law because this is in his wheelhouse in every way. The DIY root beer science kit I'm getting for my 8-year-old because he has recently discovered root beer and he likes learning. So this is going to be a really fun project for the both of us. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ATTWG. That's uncommongoods.com/ATTWG for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.